This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Excellence Dividend, Meeting the Tech Tide with Work That Wows and Jobs That Last. This is the author, Tom Peters. Dedication. Susan Sargent, Inspiration, Prod, Steadfast Partner. Captain Richard E. Anderson, Civil Engineer Corps, United States Navy. Role Model, Mentor Extraordinaire. Gene Webb, Igniter-in-Chief of Intellectual Fires. Bob Waterman, Best Mate in Pursuit of Excellence. Harry Rhodes, Faithful Pal, Game Changer. Darrell Kolb, Kiwi Instigator. Herb Kelleher, The One and Only. Richard Branson, The One and Only. Anita Roddick, The One and Only. Larry Janeski, King of Basements. Jim Penman, Loves the Tasks We Hate. Vernon Hill, Contrarian, Wowmeister, Fanmaker, Job Creator. Esther Newberg, Sine Qua Non. Sunny Mehta, Sine Qua Non. Epigraph. Excellence, the Triumph of Humanity. Janet Dugan, a healthcare architect, took inspiration from her recent experience having an MRI scan, magnetic resonance imaging. While she was lying still and waiting, she noticed a small mirror that had been placed below the head support piece. It was angled so that she could see through the barrel to the radiology technician and make eye contact with him. What a small thing, she told me, and yet what a difference it made. I felt less alone. I was connected to another person at the very moment I needed support. And even though I'm not claustrophobic, it calmed me some to be able to see out of the barrel. I saw that the technician was friendly and that the nurse went out of her way to make me laugh. I firmly believe in the power of design to contribute to the healing process, that architecture can shape events and transform lives. But that day, in that experience, the thing that really gave me comfort was a tiny mirror about as big as a Band-Aid. Tim Liebrecht, The Business Romantic, Give Everything, Quantify Nothing, and Create Something Greater Than Yourself. The Pitch, Excellence Now More Than Ever. When In Search of Excellence was published in 1982, America's mood was dire. Recession raged, unemployment stood at 10.8%, the highest since the Great Depression, and Japan's mighty Keiretsu were threatening a wide range of American industries, from automobile manufacturers and banks to electronics firms and steelmakers. MBAs, and I was one, had ascended to the top of American business. They tended to relentlessly focus on abstractions, the spreadsheet, the bottom line, the strategic plan. Japanese business chiefs had a different emphasis, an unrelenting quest for continuous product improvement marked by the involvement of every employee every day. America's passionless obsession with numbers, numbers, and more numbers was the opening that Japan needed to embarrass us. The automotive industry was especially vulnerable. Compared to theirs, our cars were clunkers. This quote from Honda founder Sachiro Honda overstates the case, but his point is all too well taken. When Congress passes new emissions standards, we hire 50 more engineers and GM hires 50 more lawyers. Ouch. The In Search of Excellence message was that some U.S. companies did focus on what was right. Developing people, obsessing on product quality, seeking inspiring design, and listening to the engineers more intently than to the finance department staffers. As a result, they were scoring in the marketplace. All of us, my co-author Bob Waterman and I argued, could learn from these American exemplars of excellence. I consider this book, The Excellence Dividend, arriving in an equally troubling time, to be a sequel of sorts to In Search of Excellence. Excellence 2, if you will, but more on that in a moment. Today's economy is in surprisingly good shape given the depth of the hole that we were in 10 years ago. But there are big exceptions. In particular, growing income inequality and an enormous and restless underemployed class. However, there's a larger threat looming, one that's been building for a long time, and which, over the next 5 to 15 or 20 years, is likely going to knock us back on our heels with once-in-a-century consequences. It's not globalization, it's not immigration, it's technology. Entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and Silicon Valley icon Mark Andreessen says, "Software is eating the world." An alarming Oxford University analysis claims that in the next two decades, nearly 50% of American white-collar jobs are at risk, either to automation or to AI, artificial intelligence. The first 30 years of advanced automation brought robots and mass layoffs to factories, and via software, eliminated the jobs of those who performed routine white-collar tasks. Says Daniel Huttenlocher, dean of Cornell Tech, "The Industrial Revolution was about augmenting and replacing physical labor, and the Digital Revolution has been about augmenting and replacing mental labor." What's changed is that automation is no longer just occurring in the realm of repetitive tasks, whether blue-collar or white. Instead, smarter machines learn on the job, so-called deep learning, and see patterns based on enormous data troves and draw conclusions that humans can often not find. Artificial intelligence-driven devices can spot tumors on CT scans better than pathologists and radiologists. Machine learning pioneer Jeffrey Hinton said, "If you work as a radiologist, you are like Wile E. Coyote in the cartoon. You're already over the edge of the cliff, but you haven't looked down." Hinton went so far as to recommend that med schools stop training radiologists right now. AI also drives the overwhelming majority of trading in stocks and bonds. As Vasant Dhar, a New York University professor and developer of hedge fund trading programs, noted, "At the end of the day, you have to ask yourself what will be left for humans to do that machines can't do as well or better. Can we fight back against this likely employment apocalypse? While I hardly dismiss the impending turmoil, I run to optimism. And it is that optimism that leads me to think in terms of excellence too, focusing on the human attributes that will, if effectively deployed, likely remain beyond the realm of artificial intelligence. For example, the quality of fully engaged employees providing personalized service that makes you smile as it's delivered and creates fond memories that last. Or the design excellence that made Steve Jobs' Apple products, more driven by his months sitting quietly in Japanese gardens than by computer coding skills, worthy of the head-shaking amazement of hundreds of millions of customers. Truth be told, I've had a love affair with excellence throughout my career. I believe, and oh how deeply I believe, that excellence is far more than just an organizing business principle that can be reduced to a series of quote-unquote success traits. Excellence can be the way we live our lives, professional as well as personal, the way we support one another, particularly in difficult times. Excellence is the seemingly small acts that shout, "We care," and which linger in the memories of those we interact with, our own people, our communities, our suppliers, our customers. Here's an example that's literally close to home. Not long ago, my wife and I had 50 trees planted on the border of our property in southern Massachusetts. She's the gardener-in-chief, and I was the designated waterer-in-chief. That translated into an hour-a-day task that entailed dragging about 200 yards of heavy-duty hose hither and thither. The person who helps us with the lawn in my wife's gardens has to move that bulky hose out of his way when he cuts the grass. To do so, he thoughtfully coiled it with the utmost care so that when I had to drag it back out to water the trees, there were no kinks, a smooth flow, and the chore was made easy. It was a small but critical act of, yes, excellence. It's tempting to dismiss hose coiling as unimportant when compared with the precision needed to design a computer or run a global business, but that is dead wrong. I spent my adult life studying excellence, marveling at all its myriad manifestations. And this seemingly tiny display of attention and care is precisely the sort of thing I will remember. And not just when I water our trees, but when I lecture to business leaders around the world about how to build organizations that do things differently, that do things in ways that engender fond and lasting memories in their customers' heads and hearts. So what is the excellence dividend? In short, businesses that are committed to excellence in every aspect of their internal and external dealings are likely to survive. They are better and more spirited places to work. Their employees are engaged and growing and preparing for tomorrow. Their customers are happier and inclined to spread tales of their excellence far and wide. Their communities welcome them as good neighbors. Their vendors welcome them as reliable partners. That, in turn, translates directly into bottom-line results and growth. And, AI and robotics notwithstanding, it translates into jobs that last and the likely creation of new jobs as well. To observe the excellence dividend at work, let's move beyond garden hoses and talk about dog biscuits in a global retail banking revolution. Or, rather, let's turn to Vernon Hill, founder of Commerce Bank in the United States and now Metro Bank in the United Kingdom. For years, the retail banking model, as software moved to every desktop and countertop and then to every pocket, has been to abandon bricks-and-mortar branches and compel customers to use ATMs and now smartphones and to perform as many transactions as possible online. Hill, the contrarian, opened Commerce Bank and said in effect, "We want them in the branches where we can get beyond soulless transactions and turn an inhuman account number into a fully engaged member of our family." His plan was to build gorgeous, colorful, pulsating stores, the Commerce Metro term for branches, pay good wages, train like crazy, and fill the stores with enthusiastic employees who would provide sterling service and convert customers into fans, one of Hill's favorite terms. Very long hours have been one signature of the Commerce Metro experience. His branches are open a previously unheard of 7 days a week and until, midnight on Fridays. The most complex transactions are completed in a flash. No problem is too convoluted that it can't be solved autonomously by frontline staffers taught literally never to say no. For instance, when a computer glitch occurred at one point, an employee went so far as to put a customer plane ticket charge on her personal credit card in order to preserve that customer's deeply discounted, time-sensitive airfare. Her imaginative act earned kudos from bank management, let alone the shock and awe of the customer. To top it off, the bank has always advertised itself as dog-friendly. Its ubiquitous mascot, Duffy, Sir Duffield in the United Kingdom, is featured in every promotion. Come to the bank and you'll likely leave, as I did in London, with a bright red dog bowl emblazoned with the bank's logo, a pooper scooper, also with logo, and of course, dog biscuits. The biscuits giveaway count, featured in an annual report a few years ago, totaled 2 million. In 2007, Hill sold Commerce Bank to TD Bank for $8.6 billion, a rousing testament to the effectiveness of his contrarian, fan-generating approach. He rested for a while, but couldn't remain idle for long. So he took his Wow Bank philosophy across the Atlantic. The innovative Metro Bank became the first new major chartered bank in the United Kingdom in 150 years. He'll put on his version of the greatest show on earth. The British bought the whole act. Thousands come out for branch, that is, store openings, join in the fun, and in short order, Metro had more than 1 million accounts. Oh. And his UK customers took to dog-friendly even more avidly than their American counterparts. In a nutshell, what Hill and his associates brought to the staid, stagnant banking business was bold, brash, colorful, fun, energetic excellence. And they delivered it in a human-centered way that created memorable, emotion-laden experiences that earned millions of loyal fans. But it's not just customers who've benefited. Hill and his management team, first at Commerce, now at Metro, have created more than 17,000 good new jobs.
While traditional banks,
consumed by technology's efficiency-first approach, closed branches, left empty buildings behind, and slashed jobs by the tens of thousands. The Commerce Metro Bank mantra. Are you going to cost-cut your way to prosperity, or are you going to spend your way to prosperity? Overinvest in our people, overinvest in our facilities. Cost-cutting is a death spiral. Our whole story is growing revenue. As Hill and his associates have demonstrated, excellence that sticks is achievable in 2018 and achievable in big arenas where the herd is moving, obsessed with technology for technology's sake, in the polar opposite direction. But as you'll find in the pages that follow, there's an implicit warning accompanying this heartening story. Excellence is damned hard work, and the pursuit thereof is unrelenting. Excellence, Commerce and Metro flavor, cannot be turned over to the code writers and is definitely not for the faint of heart. Maintaining the bank's culture is a minute at a time, hour at a time, forever affair. This book is about hard work and unrelenting development and maintenance of a culture of excellence. But it is not a guide to defending yourself in the midst of disruptions that have become commonplace and will be so for the foreseeable future. No, it is decidedly not about defense. It's about going on the offensive, creating right now excellence anywhere and everywhere, delighting customers with dog bowls, dog biscuits, a never-say-no attitude, recruiting a team of optimists, then showering them with training and development opportunities that prepare them for an uncertain future, and keep them in a mood consistent with providing service that invariably wows, 7 days a week and until midnight on Fridays. As software replaces jobs, all industries all over the world are at risk. The technology is there already. The only issue is timing. 5 years? 10 years? 15? How long will it be before technology guts the job market? And are we, in the end, fighting a losing battle? My response to that question is an unequivocal no. My bottom line is that there is an effective way to master and profit from the madness. And yes, the answer is excellence. Excellence reflected in the staff's attitude toward the coming day. Excellence that translates into an emotional bond with customers and communities in a way that cannot, and I predict will not, be replaceable by algorithms in the foreseeable future. Excellence, to repeat, is a human-driven affair, a state of mind, not a computer-generated exercise. Excellence is a perfectly coiled hose, coiled with care, that makes my hillside watering task a lark, or at least a lot easier. Excellence is 2 million dog biscuits and a staff of thousands who never say no and live to produce a wow in any and all transactions. Excellence, per Steve Jobs, is a design so good that you, quote, want to lick it, unquote, and a design-mindedness translated as fully to the care that goes into creating the boxes in which Apple products come as to the software that powers them. Hose, dog biscuits, lickability, excellence, 2018. It is hard work, but it is eminently doable and infinitely rewarding at a personal as well as professional level. The basis for no less than economic revival at both local and national levels. And at least as true or more so for the millions upon millions working in the likes of two-person lawn and garden businesses as for those in giant firms that grab all the headlines. Oh, and please trust me on this, a hell of a lot of fun. Witness customer smiles, employee growth, and the community's applause. Excellence is profitable. Excellence is security. Excellence is a kick. Believe it. Excellence Dividend, the plot. Excellence, always. If not excellence, what? If not excellence now, when? Excellence. The story comes in 15 parts. Each stands alone. Each is an integral and integrated part of a larger whole called excellence. The why. Excellence in all we do at this madcap moment in particular, and for a variety of reasons, is the best, I'm tempted to say the only, high-probability strategy for personal and enterprise success. I repeat, the excellence story herein is not about defense and surviving. The excellence story is about offense and thriving. On a very personal note, I'd add that this book, though fully engaged with today's tumultuous times, took 50-plus years to write, starting in 1966 with my first management job and the lucky break of a boss who would accept no less than excellence. The saga. You suffer through a 100-slide PowerPoint presentation. The first 95 slides focus on market analysis, competitor strength, and numbers, numbers, numbers. That is, abstractions, abstractions, abstractions. The finale, if we even get there, is a rush through 5 dense pages of to-dos. Well, damn it, I want the to-dos and the processes and people associated therewith to be the last 50 slides in that presentation. Better yet, a 20-slide presentation with the last 10 or more devoted to the how-to, to-do, who-do. I approvingly quote Omar Bradley, the commander of U.S. troops at the World War II D-Day landing. Amateurs talk about strategy. Professionals talk about logistics. In this book, you better believe that I talk about logistics and that execution comes precisely where it belongs, first. Execution is front, center, first, not AWOL. It is the sole topic of Section 1 and Chapter 1. The book's second section is, what else? Excellence. The first excellence examination, Chapter 2, consists of 14 takes on excellence. We begin with the purposefully soaring notion that excellence in management is a grand human achievement. That is, effectively organizing and energizing our fellow human beings to attain extraordinary ends on a soccer team, in a symphonic production, in an ICU, in a training department is the highest of arts. Effectively organizing is what humans did to move beyond our pre-human ancestors. My aim is pointing out that this organizational pursuit of service through excellence is an enormous and soul-filling opportunity. A second snapshot worth singling out here is the one that begets the chapter title. Excellence is the next 5 minutes. Excellence is typically seen as a grand aspiration, an Olympian mountaintop to be reached, the acme of a 10-year plan. Not so. I will argue as stridently as I can that excellence is the boss's next chance meeting in the hall, the next phone call, and, yes, the next 10-line email or 2-line instant message. Excellence is a moment-to-moment way of life, or it is nothing at all. There is no tomorrow in excellence. There is only right now. Excellence is sustained by one and only one thing, a culture of excellence. And that culture of excellence is the topic of Chapter 3. MIT's longtime organizational effectiveness guru, Ed Schein, famously said, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." Culture, pure and simple, is the bedrock of any and all of the manifestations of excellence described above in Chapter 2. Implication number 1, cultural development and maintenance is CEO job 1. Moreover, tending to the culture is a full-time job. Chapter 4 takes a turn particularly important for the times. The topic is SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. To deal with the forces descending upon us, we need energy, verve, imagination, and artistry, and a source of new jobs. The fact is, these positives are rarely associated with giant firms, and I present unassailable data to support that unsettling assertion. Smaller outfits are unequivocally the job producers, about 80% of new jobs all around the world, and the premier innovators. A special effort is made in this chapter to demonstrate that enterprise excellence is most decidedly not the exclusive domain of the likes of the denizens of Silicon Valley. Our exemplars will include Basement Systems Incorporated, a fast-growing Connecticut firm that logs $100 million in revenue, drying out residential basements and turning them into family rooms or extra bedrooms, and a parking garage, yes, a parking garage, in Miami, 1111 Lincoln Road, that has become a cultural icon and center for everything from morning yoga classes to major entertainment events. Excellence, here, there, and everywhere. Section 3 is the people stuff. As I repeatedly say and have said in every one of my roughly 3,000 presentations spanning 4 decades, why in the world must I shout "people first" at the top of my lungs, again and again and then again? Why isn't it as obvious as the end of your nose and down to your toenails? I don't know, but here I go again. We start with Chapter 5, One More Damn Time, Putting People First. By my accounting, People First is always ranked number one on the Basis for Excellence scorecard, but it is more number one in 2018 than ever before, in fact, by a long shot. The headlines these days are chock-a-block with tales about replacing people, by the millions, with robots and advanced AI. All of this book's headlines are about pursuing excellence with imagination and vigor through turned-on, growth-obsessed people. Take note. The AI is there, to be sure, but its primary role is to abet workers' efforts to deliver consistently excellent customer experiences, not to replace those workers. So in my book, and this damn well is my book, People First is far more intensely the message today than it was in our first excellence effort in 1982. And as then, I never understand why business people so rarely get it in the same way a symphony or ballet or theater company leader, a sports coach, or a lab boss does. If a football team, though assisted these days by big data analytics, is obviously the sum of its players and their effectiveness as a team, why is that not equally the case at my corner grocery store in Westport, Massachusetts? Well, in this instance, it is. The local store's staff attitude is a joy to behold. New England Patriots, Westport, Massachusetts grocer, same, same, people first. Chapter 6 singles out training. It most logically should have been a part of the prior chapter, but I believe there is a compelling need to make a standalone standout argument and to use a strong word in doing so, namely mania, as in training mania. You want the customer to experience excellence and delight and become a fan and stay a fan. Then you need each and every employee to be part of a fully engaged team and to be devoted to personal growth. Matthew Kelly, in his book The Dream Manager, based upon a housekeeping services company, contends that if you want employees to contribute heart and mind to the enterprise, then you must commit heart and mind to helping them achieve their dreams, to develop as persons who not only serve today's customers with verve, but are in a position to move on and move forward in the crazy, crazy getting crazier world in which they are embedded. Chapter 7, next up in the people section, directly confronts and examines the new technologies. Titled Tech Tsunami, White Collar Apocalypse, The New Moral Imperative, it lays out the story of indeed highly likely apocalyptic change. And I also lay down the law. Or Richard Branson lays down his law. He says, business has to give people enriching, rewarding lives, or it is simply not worth doing. Then I lay down my law, which I call Corporate Mandate 2018, namely, your principal moral obligation as a leader is to develop the skill set of every one of the people in your charge, temporary as well as semi-permanent, to the maximum extent of your abilities and consistent with their revolutionary needs in the years ahead. The bonus, this is also the number one profit maximization strategy. In short, the idea of contemporary business's moral imperative is the bedrock of this book. In Chapter 8, Job Security in an Insecure World, we turn to the individual's mandate, or rather, opportunity. In 1999, I offered up a book titled The Brand You 50, 50 Ways to Transform Yourself from an Employee into a Brand That Shouts Distinction, Commitment, and Passion. What I felt was a good idea then is no less than a mandate today. It also underscores my earlier defense versus offensive argument. I do not see Brand U as a defense against AI. I see it as an offensive strategy for you and your peers to build exciting lives that in fact take full advantage of the new technology. Next up, Innovation, Section 4. And first up therein, Chapter 9. Whoever tries the most stuff wins. Whoever screws the most stuff up wins. There's lots to say about innovation, and I've said a lot over the years. But in this section, I limit myself to two principal ideas. Whoever tries the most stuff wins is the first. I've long been a vociferous enemy of spending an inordinate amount of time on planning. For example, number one among the eight basics featured in Search of Excellence was a bias for action. 3M, my favorite company in that 1982 book, and a superstar almost 40 years later, was one giant playground. And in this chapter, among other things, I tout a superb book appropriately titled Serious Play. As the author said, you can't be a serious innovator unless and until you are ready, willing, and able to seriously play. Serious play. No big planning departments. Damn little formality. Zestfully jump in and then see what happens. Folks in every nook and every cranny of the organization talking about something for a short while, then turning out a half-assed prototype in a flash, then fiddling with it and playing some more. Mistakes are regularly celebrated as essential steps on the path to progress. One successful CEO innovator says he owes his success to a three-word motto, fail, forward, fast. The catch with all this, the wildly accelerating pace of change in 2018 requires an animated, all-hands, whoever-tries-the-most-stuff-wins culture, as I will examine in depth. Though popularized in Silicon Valley, establishing such a rockin' and rollin' culture goes against the grain in most settings, and breaking that case-hardened mold is no walk in the park. Chapter 10 encompasses the second of the two big ideas in this section on innovation. We are who we hang out with. The story can be condensed as follows. Weird times require hanging out obsessively with weird people who relentlessly challenge our views and say the strangest damn things. Motto, same, same kills in 2018. If you recognize all the folks wandering in the hall at your workplace, or if three-quarters of your team have the same background and the same point of view, which is all too commonplace, well, you are in deep trouble. We'll also see that the war on same, same extends from the front line to especially the boardroom. Low board diversity equals very common equals life-threatening. Section 5. In an age of AI-abetted friction-free supply chains and AI-abetted soulless transactions, efficiency and cost minimization are de facto the beginning and the end of the Regnant story. But hold on for a beat and remember the Metro Bank axiom. Cost-cutting is a death spiral. Our whole story is growing revenue. In precisely that spirit, this section, Adding Value, a Top-Line Obsession, is devoted to nine sources of top-line enhancement. In chapter 11, A Passion for Design, differentiator number 1, I single out engaging design as first among equals in the value-added tale. There's a special angle to this story. Design is great functionality, yes. Design is appealing aesthetics, yes. But the essence of design excellence goes much further. It's all about lasting emotional connection. Starbucks Howard Schultz wants us to have a, quote, romance, unquote, with his shops. Damned if I know why, but I do, on the road in Saudi Arabia as well as at home in Boston. Notions such as Schultz's animate this chapter. And, of the utmost importance, such notions apply as much to the local service station or a 6-person purchasing department or the 27-year-old independent contractor making her way in the gig economy as they do to Starbucks. The other 8 value-added sources are covered in Chapter 12. They include an abiding emphasis on services added. Rolls-Royce, for example, now makes more money from adjunct services than from producing aircraft engines. UPS in 2018 is more about logistics systems management than it is about tossing packages on the back porch. The hell-bent use of social media by one and all is also front and center here. Among other things, you will be introduced to a financial services CEO who insists that he would rather have a Twitter conversation with one customer than spend millions of dollars on the purchase of a Super Bowl ad. Also on the new technology front, the game-changing impact of big data and IoT, the Internet of Things, are given their due. 2 gigantic and absurdly underserved, absurdly financially endowed markets will be examined in detail. Women are effectively the premier purchasers of, well, everything. Too few companies, even in 2018, get it. Among other things, the most surefire way to take advantage of the women's market is to have a top team that looks like the market. That is, a senior management team and board with female majorities. The other underserved behemoth market is seniors. Their total purchasing power is staggering and dramatically exceeds that of their younger cohorts, who are absurdly the focus of most marketing efforts. Section 6, the finale, is a journey toward leadership excellence. I describe it as quote-unquote some stuff. The point of that odd and seemingly lightweight designation is that I am not offering a grand design or mystical formula for organizational or individual transformation. In fact, I avoid like the plague such words as vision, authenticity, disruption, and transformation. My aim here is tactical and practical. I will offer you proven over and over and over again, ideas to increase your leadership effectiveness today and to ignite your march toward excellence today. Remember the bedrock. Excellence is the next 5 minutes. Tactics that work, tactics that you can begin to apply this afternoon. Tactics that, taken together and applied repetitively, will move you many, many steps down the road to leadership excellence. The first of the 3 leadership chapters, chapter 13, is titled Listening, the Bedrock of Leadership Excellence. I gave serious thought to making listening chapter 1. If so, I would have been following the lead of Richard Branson, who devoted the entire first third, well over 100 pages, of his recent leadership book, The Virgin Way: How to Listen, Learn, Laugh, and Lead, to listening per se. Instead, I choose to single out listening as item number 1 in this leadership section, worthy beyond doubt of a standalone chapter. Along the way, I will also argue that an enterprise-wide commitment to what one leadership expert calls fierce listening is the top candidate for core value number 1. The second topic to be singled out in the leadership section is chapter 14, is the abiding importance of an organization's full complement of first-line managers. Sergeants run the Army and chief petty officers run the Navy, and the armed services damn well understand that and act accordingly. Likewise, first-line leaders are, as I see it, a business organization's asset number one, but most businesses don't behave accordingly. In this chapter, I dearly hope to make a rock-solid case for changing that. The Principal Leadership chapter, Chapter 15, offers up some 26 tactics, ranging from the staggering power of thank you and I'm sorry to an analysis of the many cognitive biases that severely cloud our judgments, and some suggestions for diminishing the power of these biases. My goal is to have you dip in and get on with giving several of these tactical tips a try, right now. To repeat, applied relentlessly, these nuggets are almost guaranteed to speed up your journey toward excellence. The book's epilogue is titled CODA 2018. It adds up to a simple plea for immoderate action, fit for immoderate times. Only leaps and bounds and spirited play and the relentless pursuit of excellence and wow will add up to that offensive rather than defensive approach to mastering the trials of the times. So that's it. 15 chapters, 15 ideas. Each, in fact, is a necessary way stop on the path to excellence and surviving and thriving in the unruly times ahead. Good luck. Organizing Principle 1. On the Shoulders of Giants. 3 years ago, I began an effort to pull everything together, to capture my thoughts over the past 5-plus decades about people and organizations getting things done with excellence. The effort resulted in a monster, a 17-chapter, 4,094-slide PowerPoint product that included 100,000 words of annotation. I called it The Works. You'll find it at excellencenow.com. What follows is significantly derived from that 17-chapter blockbuster. Specifically, before starting this book, I went through the entire slide set and extracted 300 or so quotes from Hall of Fame performers. I use these gems as my raw material. The reasoning is simple and consistent with a view I've long held. While I have observed thousands of organizations and ceaselessly wrestled with the ups and downs of my own small business, the simple fact is that I have not run a Fortune 500 company, and I have not birthed the unicorn. Hence, virtually everything I have done has been done indirectly by standing upon the shoulders of giants. So what if Tom Peters thinks your employees should be your number one customer? Forget my view, but I hope you will pay attention to the likes of Southwest Airlines founder and CEO Herb Kelleher and the inimitable Richard Branson when they say precisely that. Frankly, this is their book more than mine, and I delightedly acknowledge and offer my thanks for the lessons these often contrarian exemplars of excellence have pounded into my head and heart, and which I hope, with my assistance, they pound into you. Organizing Principle 2, On Your Shoulders. When I wrote my first book, I was working as a consultant at McKinsey & Company, and I first thought that my most important readers were our big league clients or clients-to-be. But the letters of thanks I received that moved me the most were from elementary school principals, police chiefs and police lieutenants, fire chiefs, and department heads at big firms. Well, let me repeat the lesson of those letters here. The excellence dividend is aimed primarily at the boss of a 6-person training unit in a $1 billion behemoth, the proprietor of a 4-person construction firm in my hometown of Dartmouth, Massachusetts, or the likes of the police lieutenants cited immediately above. Frankly, it is their, that is your, devotion to relentlessly developing their, your, team members and turning their, your, customers or community members into fans that makes the difference in creating a vibrant local and national economy. I do dearly hope these pages inspire you to renew your passion for and commitment to excellence. It matters now far more than ever before. Section 1. Execution. Chapter 1. Execution, First Among Equals. My story. Each chapter actually begins with a personal reflection that aims to explain how the essential idea first got under my skin, followed by a linear narrative that fleshes out the notion under consideration. How two simple words, can, do, started me on a 50-year caper. Too many business books offer marketing secrets that sizzle, or give us a surefire formula for coping with permanent disruption, or offer how-tos for creating a knock-'em-dead strategy. The peerless strategy is codified and approved to much applause, and then nothing, or at least not much. And the pattern is repeated time and time again. To frame my response to this sorry state of affairs, let's step back for a moment, some 75 years. After Pearl Harbor, the United States started its pushback trek across the Pacific. That meant hopping from island to island in the middle of nowhere. At home, Admiral Ben Morrell, the chief of the U.S. Navy's Bureau of Yards and Docks and Civil Engineer Corps, also started hopping. In his case, from one construction trade union hall to another. He was recruiting for the Navy's new construction battalions, which would build the roads and airstrips and whatever else was needed to support the troops fighting their way across the Pacific. Admiral Morrell told the union members that he had a job for them, a damned important job. They wouldn't have to worry about saluting, keeping shoes polished until they gleamed, and standing at attention on parade grounds. They were being recruited for one and only one thing, to build stuff fast, using whatever equipment in whatever condition was on hand, with no excuses tolerated. And build they did. They completed airstrips carved out of rock that were operational in as little as 12 days from start to finish. Working all night under fire, they made major airfield repairs after the strips had been bombed into a moonscape during the daylight hours. The motto of the U.S. Navy's no-frills builders, or CBs, for construction battalions, was two words, can do. The CBs time and again, month after month, casualty after casualty, worked miracles. No bullshit, no crisp salutes, a bridge, a road, an airstrip, just build it, now. John Wayne even starred in a famous 1944 movie titled The Fighting CBs. In 1966, 20 years after the end of World War II, I landed on a hot August night in Da Nang, Vietnam, and debarked from a C-141 aircraft along with 100 or so of my new Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 9, NMCB 9 mates. I was a 23-year-old U.S. Navy ensign, greener than green. After giving us no more than a half an hour to settle in, our commanding officer, a hardened World War II CB, gathered the contingent of young officers who had just arrived and gave us our orders. For the next 9 months, he said, we would be responsible for building stuff. 7 days a week, dawn to dusk, and all night if necessary. Vietnam's four-month monsoon would not be a problem. Bad guys mining the roads we were building would not be a problem. Nothing would be a problem. We were there to build, build, build. The material would never be what we needed. The earth-moving equipment would be inadequate and often on its last legs. No matter, no formalities, no spit, no polish, just build stuff. And build it fast, and build it right. End of story. We saluted and de facto said in unison, can, do. My two tours in 14 months in Vietnam were my first management assignments, and they left an indelible impression. Cut the bullshit, can the excuses, forget the fancy reports, get moving, now, get the job done. On this score, nothing has changed in 50 years, including the maddening fact that all too often, the strategy is inspiring, but the execution mania is largely AWOL. Lesson 1966, lesson 2018, forget that glossy strategy, just build it now. Can do. The execution narrative. 1.1. Execution in a nutshell. The shower curtain axiom. Conrad Hilton, at a gala celebrating his remarkable career, was called to the podium and asked, "What were the most important lessons you learned in your long and distinguished career?" His answer, in full, "Remember to tuck the shower curtain inside the bathtub." This Hiltonism earns pride of place in the excellence dividend. In fact, it has been the first slide in virtually every presentation I've given in the last 5 years. In the hotel business, location, 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 and a great architect matter. They entice me through the door. But it's that tucked-in shower curtain that brings me back and induces me to recommend the hotel to my friends. And as business people know so well, you typically lose money on that first transaction and rake in the dollars on transaction number 18, 19, and 20, and via that vital, and one hopes viral, word of mouth and word of mouse. What holds for hotels holds, well, universally. 1.2. Execution. 5 takes. 1.2.1. Execution equals strategy. Execution is strategy. Fred Malik. Fred Malik was my White House Office of Management and Budget boss in 1973 and 1974. Prior to public service, he'd been a very successful entrepreneur. I owe him a lot for passing on his dogmatic, get-it-done approach to life. Every conversation with Fred featured relentless, impatient, even rude questioning about next steps, starting with the next steps to be taken today. And tomorrow, you damn well better be able to report concrete progress. Maybe we did miss some strategic opportunities as a result of this overwhelming bias for action, as I later called it. But Fred's team had an almost awe-inspiring reputation for somehow making the impossible actually happen in the labyrinth of a tangle of federal bureaucracies and even in the halls of Congress. While I am an avowed enemy of management by intimidation, I will admit that contemplating giving Fred a "not sure what so-and-so thinks" was enough to, at one point, spur me to take a body-busting 48-hour round trip from Washington to Bangkok and back so I could provide him with an eyewitness account of our ambassador's reaction to a drug interdiction policy we were on the verge of taking public. 1.2.2. Keep it simple. Costco figured out the big simple things and executed with total fanaticism. Charles Munger, Vice Chairman, Berkshire Hathaway. Concise, simple, execute, fanaticism. Spot on. FYI, Costco's performance has been exceptional. 1.2.3, Jack Welch's mantra. In real life, strategy is actually very straightforward. Pick a general direction and implement like hell. Jack Welch. Former GE Chief Executive Welch and strategic genius were synonymous in the telling by management gurus. But the conventional narrative was almost total fiction. Welch was an executionist of the first order. You got an assignment at GE and you delivered, or not. The or nots were not long for GE. Do also note Welch's definition of strategy, general direction. My response would be amen. A detailed strategy is stuff and nonsense. You head off in that general direction, and as you go, the environment shifts shape again and again and then again. Going with that shape shifting is the key to success. And only rarely, if you're open-minded to opportunities, do you end up anywhere near where you first imagined. And in 9 out of 10 cases, that's a good thing. Incidentally, when Welch took the helm at GE, one of his first steps was to slash the headquarters strategic planning staff. The thick staffer-written tome of yore was to be replaced with no more than a page or two drafted by the line executive responsible for implementation. 1.2.4. Amateurs and professionals. Recall from the introduction. Amateurs talk about strategy. Professionals talk about logistics. General Omar Bradley, commander of American troops on D-Day. Again, amen. General Bradley's axiom always makes me smile, grin, weep, leap with joy. I'd add that I consider it practical guidance, not a clever saying. The Bradley axiom has long been bedrock military dogma. Getting the fuel for the tanks to the right place at the right time is success key number one on the battlefield and concern number one for generals who win battles. The private sector story, big business or small, is precisely the same. 1.2.5. The thrill of getting things done. Execution is the job of the business leader. The first things I look for in a job candidate are energy and enthusiasm for execution. Does the candidate talk about the thrill of getting things done, or does she keep wandering back to strategy or philosophy? Does she detail the obstacles she has overcome, the roles played by the people assigned to her? Larry Bossidy and Ram Charan, Execution, the Discipline of Getting Things Done. Bossidy was a former GE vice chairman and subsequently CEO of Allied Signal. Charan is a longtime business consultant and author. This is deceptively simple. And to simplify even further, people who talk about execution are more likely than others to spend their time on execution, and vice versa. This is a great story and a first-order hiring suggestion. Theoretician or pragmatist? People person or not? If a candidate does not talk about his or her team with pride and fondness, I advise you to run like hell in the opposite direction. Strong advice. Read this quote twice. Act on it. Turn it into policy and action. 1.3. No turning back. Ulysses S. Grant. One of my superstitions had always been when I started to go anywhere or do anything not to turn back or stop until the intended thing was accomplished. Ulysses S. Grant. The art of war is simple enough. Find out where your enemy is, get at him as soon as you can, strike at him as hard as you can and as often as you can, and keep moving on. Ulysses S. Grant. Grant had an extreme, almost phobic dislike of turning back and retracing his steps. If he set out for somewhere, he would get there somehow, whatever the difficulties that lay in his way. This idiosyncrasy would turn out to be one of the factors that made him such a formidable general. Grant would always, always press on. Turning back was not an option for him. Michael Korda, Ulysses S. Grant, The Unlikely Hero. Grant kept the enemy off balance. His armies were constantly on the move. As author Josiah Bunting said in Ulysses S. Grant, the general had, quote, an almost inhuman disinterest in strategy, unquote. Summary. No interest in grand strategy. Do the thing until it is done. Do not overcomplicate. Do the next thing. Grant, for whom my admiration knows virtually no bounds, was a man of action amid a sea of procrastinators, such as his predecessor, General George McClellan. Grant's obsession for perpetual forward movement was matched by a reputation for untrammeled relentlessness. In effect, those twin traits, which defined him and made him President Lincoln's favorite general, won the war for the Union. It wasn't always pretty. In fact, at times it was downright ugly. But Grant persevered, never stopped pushing, always kept moving, never turned back as much as an inch, no matter how dire the circumstances, and got the job done. 1.4. Interviews. We beats I. Observed closely and quantitatively the use of I or we in the course of a job interview. Leonard Berry and Kent Seltman, Chapter 6, Hiring for Values, in Management Lessons from Mayo Clinic. The book, by the way, is a masterpiece concerning healthcare practices and in general. Such a simple idea, literally counting the number of times a person says I or we in a hiring interview, but how extraordinarily important. The practitioner in this instance, Mayo Clinic, has differentiated itself in general and in medicine in particular with its century-old, first stated by William Mayo in 1914, abiding emphasis on cooperative medicine. And Mayo's leaders have discovered that, for one thing, using more we than I in an interview is a pretty darn good indicator of a future proclivity for focusing on teammates rather than oneself. All of this is crucial to execution, the ultimate we business. Let me also note, this I-we metric applies across the board. That is, interviews of star MDs seeking a position at Mayo. I am hundreds of times better here than in my prior hospital assignment because of the support system. It's like you are working in an organism. You are not a single cell when you are out there practicing. Dr. Nina Schwenk, in chapter